The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
How's everybody? Oh, come on. How's everybody? So I'm supposed to do this because it's the library, right? I'm State Senator Vincent Hughes, all right? This should be formal. Formal. It's the library. You got to be formal, right? You know, I'm State Senator Vincent Hughes. All right, so isn't it cool to be in the library? Isn't it cool to be in the library? So, like, This is not supposed to be about me, but she gave me the mic, so, you know, I mean, for real. But I used to work in a library, and I had the most important job in any library in the world. Can anyone tell me what that job is?
Shelving books.
Who says shelving books? My main man, you win the prize. I don't know what the prize is, but it's, you win it, okay? All right? It's a book, okay? But shelving books, because if you put the book back in the wrong place, it's gone forever. Forever, think about it. And it was at Penn. I worked at the Penn Library, Van Pelt. Million books. And those students would hide books from one another. It was just terrible. I couldn't believe it. But this is really cool to be in a library. I'm a library person. I love libraries. I love books. There's nothing cooler than turning the page and finding what happens next. Nothing. But this is about somebody who I know extremely well. 18 years of marriage. She is still keeping me and not getting rid of me, all right? And the iconic, the Broadway, the Dream Girls, the production, the TED Talk, the TED Talk. What's up, Wendella Fox? I see all my friends walking in here. I'm sorry, I apologize for calling out names, all right? Estelle Richmond, Mary Herdig, all these people, all right? But Marva Allen, so I'll stop. But it is the significant thing about her career is that when she won the Emmy for this little TV show based on a school in West Philly, I'm just saying, all right? Her message was not about her victory, but it's a message about empowering you and lifting yourselves up and believing in yourselves. And that's who she is. That's what she embodies. That is very authentic. It's very real. All these folks always show up at the house, okay? Cheryl, who are these people showing up at the house? Well, they needed to talk, and I needed to talk to them, you know? Okay. But it's like that. It's real. And I think you'll find that out this evening. And I think it's probably why this room is so full on an August evening when... That's why you're here. When, just for information purposes, Bryce Harper's already hit a 2-run home run over the Giants, all right? So, not that we're distracted by anything else, right? Okay? But ladies and gentlemen, the wonderful, the fabulous Tracy Matisak, give her a round of applause, please. The voice you love, but the brain you just adore, Tracy Matisak. She's going to be interviewing and talking to Shirley Ralph this evening, but I just said it. Here she is, my dream girl. My dream girl, Cheryl Lee Ralph.
my goodness. Thank you. Thank you.
I think they almost like you up in here.
I mean. Hi, Tracy. Hi, everybody.
Well, thank you all for coming out here tonight. I am not surprised to see that we have a full house for Cheryl Lee Ralph, and we are excited. So,
thank you.
If you've been to the library for other events like this, you know that we do have a conversation, and then we've budgeted some time for your questions as well. So we will get as many questions in as we possibly can before we have to say goodnight. But all of that said, Cheryl Lee Ralph, we are delighted to have you at the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So the book is called Diva 2.0, 12 Life Lessons from Me for You. And I want to get to the book in just a moment. But before we get to the book, we have to talk about the show because we do love us some Abbott Elementary around these parts. And of course, we love Mrs. Howard. And the show has won lots of awards. Obviously, it's been renewed for a third season. Mm-hmm. A lot of excitement around it. And then the writer's strike, and
yes,
in fact, backstage, you were dialed into a union meeting listening
yes
to the latest. So can you tell us where things stand and when we might see another season of Abbott Elementary?
We have absolutely no idea. None. Because two things are happening simultaneously. The Writers Guild have been on strike for well over 100 days, and now SAG-AFTRA, we are also on strike. Everybody knows that this has been a hot union summer, and it should be. Yes, thank you. Today was a national day of union solidarity. Raise your hands if you know anybody who's in a union. Oh, yes, I love that. You know, there's one thing that all workers really want and really deserve, and that is to get paid. That it is also that we want good contracts and safe working environments. And we want the contracts that we negotiate to be able to keep up with the times, which is why we are also fighting for the right to our own image. Artificial intelligence is real. And there is no reason that anybody should be able to scan your body, your movements, how you move, put maybe somebody else's face on it, and you get nothing from it. That's not right. So when you hear about actors striking, it's not just actors. You know, we have a union that's made up of actors, dancers, singers, disc jockeys. We've got people in television stations here in Philadelphia that are part of the union. And these are not people making millions of dollars. These are ordinary working people. So when you hear us on strike, it is not to get Tom Cruise more money.
Amen.
Yeah.
Well, and we certainly hope that things get resolved soon because we want to see all of that settled.
Yes.
We want to see more of the show. And,
yes.
And just before we move into the book and talking about Abbott Elementary, I think, of course, we love the show because it's hilarious.
Yes.
But it also forces us to confront some uncomfortable truths about disparities in education, about how teachers are so often asked to do so much with so little, and often for pay that's far below what they're worth. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how it is that the show is able to force us to confront these things and make us laugh at the same time.
It's interesting and it's hard because I'm not able to talk about the show, but I can tell you about education. This show strikes such a chord because, quite honestly, nobody was talking about teachers until that show. Nobody was talking about education until that show. And there is a bright creative from Philadelphia by the name of Quinta Brunson. Who I swear is a mini alchemist. She has this thing sometimes when she's thinking and she just does this with her fingers and I'm like, okay, here comes the magic. Here it comes. But I really believe that it is the writer's room that we have with her leadership that they stay on point and they make magic for everybody. That show that I cannot say the name of is not the number one show in the United States. It's the number one show around the world. Thank you.
Well, so long before you became Barbara Howard, mm-hmm. you were Dena Jones, the yes. original dream girl
yes.
on Broadway. And you write at length about that time in your life, some of the lessons that you learned. And mm. you talk about what a heady time it was for you. You were in your 20s. You're the star of this smash Broadway show. You're getting all of this attention. And in a sense, your life mirrored, to some degree, the life of your character. That stardom came, and it was wonderful, but it was not without its challenges. And you said in the book that that show tested you in ways that you never could have imagined. Can you talk about some of the challenges that you faced in your life as a young person, as a big star at that time, and what you learned from those experiences?
You know, we worked so hard on Dream Girls. You know, we were all young and all ambitious and really looking forward to making it. And we went through something called the workshop process, very much like a chorus line. They took these young artists and you were in the room and you started, they would give you a scenario and then you would create from that scenario. And we all helped create this show. We signed away our rights for a dollar because we didn't know any better. The cast of A Chorus Line, they presented a class action suit. They all got paid. For whatever reason, the cast of Dream Girls did not present that suit. So I learned a great lesson, and that is no matter what, if you are young and ambitious and you are presented with a contract, get a lawyer! Because you could be like me 40 years later looking back on this incredible show and say, well, damn. Yeah, that was a rough lesson there. Another lesson was fame is, you know, sometimes fame can be really difficult. It can be, it can be hard because fame is like an energy. You know, when people love you, it's like a shield. It's like a power, you know. Sometimes I feel sorry for Beyoncé. I do. I feel sorry for some folks. I attended the Essence Fest this year, and I couldn't walk the floor because we're popular. And then it's like people, and they want to be around you. And, you know, if it's one person or 12, that's one thing. When it gets to be like 200 or 300, it's like such a wall, you know, and then it's like you can't interact the way you used to or the way that you love to. I always loved shopping in the Ross. I loved it.
I feel that. I feel
I loved it. You know, I loved shopping in TJ Maxx. Okay. I was in TJ Maxx the other day and this woman was on her phone. Yeah, she in the store. Mm-hmm. She looked good. Mm-hmm. Not Instagram good, but she looked good. You know, and it's like you have to listen. You know, what are you supposed to say? You do know I'm standing like right here. You know, but, you know, so many things about everything it just changes. And, you know, you want to be the way you were, but it's not the way that you were. But then I'm always aware of this. You can be on a pedestal today and knocked down tomorrow. How many people have you seen? Oh, they get up on the pedestal and the feel. No, what? No, don't touch me. I can't talk to you. And then, you know, they do this thing that I guess they think fame is. And then they get knocked down off that pedestal. And people are like, whatever happened to so-and-so? I'm like, wow, see, that's fame. It's mm-hmm. it's a double-edged sword, but you got to be real nice to fame because she will kick your butt.
Well, that was one of the lessons, right?
That was one of the lessons.
Way up, right?
You better be. My Aunt Virginia, great actress, Virginia Capers, she would always say, be as kind as you can to everybody because the same, she said ass, you kick today, you might have to kiss tomorrow.
That is.
Mm-hmm. And it's true. The number of PAs, production assistants, that have bought me coffee throughout my career, and now they run big companies. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I'm so glad I was nice to you.
One more Dreamgirls question before we move on, and that is that I did not know until I read the book that it was originally conceived, this Project Number 9,
yes,
as a vehicle for Nell Carter, the late,
that's right,
great Nell Carter.
That's right.
To play Effie White. I
yes.
did not know that until I read the book. And, of course, you write about how she left before the show took off,
mm-hmm.
and it was a while before a replacement was found, which
right.
ended up being Jennifer Holliday.
That's
but
right.
one of those replacements was Jennifer Lewis,
yes.
who was here last summer, for those of you who recall.
Can you imagine Jennifer Lewis as Effie Melody White? Oh, my gosh. She and I have been friends for, wow, a very long time. She and I met, I think it was after an audition for a musical review called You Be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we didn't get
show.
It, but we shared a piece of apple pie at the Howard Johnson's on Broadway, which is probably an Emporium or some sort of clothing store now on Broadway, but we sat in the window sharing a piece of apple pie, and we both had a glass of water because we didn't want to spend our money, and talking about how we were going to make it in show business.
Yeah,
isn't that crazy? And here we are.
Well, and I was fascinated to read, too, about when Jennifer Holliday came to the show. And you write about the tension that existed.
Mm-hmm.
And also about Michael Bennett's role. Michael Bennett, of course, being the late, great director and producer of that, as well as a Chorus Line. So many people think his name is synonymous with Broadway. But that was a difficult time. And you felt that he was doing some things to stir up some tension, maybe in the hope that that would carry over to the stage. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that time, about your relationship with Jennifer, but especially about working with Michael Bennett and what you learned from that challenging experience.
Michael Bennett was a creative genius. Michael was going to do anything possible to make the show work. He found a once-in-a-lifetime talent in Jennifer Holliday, and anybody who saw the original Dreamgirls will never forget the end of the first act when she sang, "And I Am Telling You I'm Not Going." They will never forget it. But she was not an actress. And what Michael decided in his head, how he was going to get the performance out of her, was to make sure she did not like me. And so it was orchestrated that we would not get along. And he was a brilliant director for that. And it was horrible. Years later, she and I sat down and she said to me, I was robbed of a friendship with you. Wow. And I had to acknowledge we were both robbed of a friendship. But she did win a Tony.
Just saying. Well, you have had no shortage of roles on stage, on screen, Moesha, Designing Women. I mean, we could go on and on. I'm going all the way back to Sidney Poitier. Piece of the action. But you've been very picky about the roles that you have played, and you write about how you never wanted to do anything that could potentially embarrass you, embarrass your family. Can you talk about that and whether that cost you maybe some opportunities? Did it?
Yeah, I have to tell you, my whole career has been intentional. I am well aware that life is about choices and the choices that we make for ourselves. And when it comes to my career, I did not want to be the naked hoe on the street, on the couch. I didn't want to be any of that. I wanted my church, my family, the kids I didn't have but I have now. I wanted them to be able to look back at my life, my career, and say, that's my mother. Yes. I wanted people to be able to say, that's Cheryl Lee Ralph. You know, and now, at this point in my career, when young men and women look at me and say, I get it, Miss Ralph. See, I did it for them. I knew they would be coming. I knew there would be other performers, actors, dreamers that come after me, and I wanted them to know you can make great choices for yourself. I also wanted to fight the image that the industry was putting out to the world about what a young black woman could do or could achieve. Yeah. So now I want them to see what an old black woman can achieve.
An old black woman over here. So it occurs to me that we would not even be sitting here having this conversation if you had followed your original path, which was to go to medical school, and you actually started down that path and something happened that diverted you in a different direction. What happened?
First of all, I am a proud graduate of Rutgers University. And I wanted to go to Rutgers because Paul Robeson graduated from Rutgers. Paul Robeson was very unique because Paul Robeson went to Rutgers on an academic scholarship. This is at the turn of the last century now. Young black man goes on an academic scholarship. He ends up graduating number one in his class. He achieved letter after letter. I think he played football, basketball, lacrosse, hockey. I think he ping pong, whatever. An amazing athlete and an incredible orator. And I said, wherever that man went to school, that's what I want to go to school. So I was in that very first class of women, but I'm an immigrant's child. My mother is a strong Jamaican immigrant, right? And my mother said, be a doctor, be a lawyer, and if you can't do that, then marry one. And I go to Rutgers, I'm going to be Dr. Ralph. I'm going to live my mother's dream for me. I get accepted. I'm a pre-med student. And I get there to that class. And it was so interesting because it was like theater for science. And they gave me this little blue velvet box. My name was engraved on this scalpel. And in front of me was a hair, H-A-R-E, which is basically a huge Easter bunny. I look at the scalpel, I look at the Easter bunny. I put that doggone thing back in that box so quickly. I walked down those stairs to that professor and I said, "My name is Cheryl Lee Ralph, and this is the last time you will see me." I walked out of there and I went to the registrar, and I was back at Rutgers, and the whole registrar was all torn down. Anyway, go to the registrar and I'm getting to the first doggone legal class I can get into. Constitutional law. I'm breaking out into a sweat just thinking about it. But I get to the campus because I have to get on the bus and go right across town, because you have to get, you know, you have to get to these classes within a certain time so that you're registered and that you can get credit. I get there. When I close the door, and this is for real, it's like a movie. Rain starts to fall. And the teacher at the front of the room was a tiny, tight woman with a Barbara Howard cardigan on. And her hair was pulled into a severe bun with these little tiny glasses. And she talked, and it was like chalk on a board. And I'm sitting there, and I'm just like, "Father God, help me. Help me. I'm not going to make it." I get up from the class. This is all one day. I get up from the class, and I exit. And now I'm walking. I'm on the Douglas campus, and I'm walking. And I don't know how I'm going to tell my mother that I am not going to be a doctor. I am not going to be a lawyer. And just as I'm about ready to burst into tears, I'm on a dead-end street. And there is a theater on the dead-end street with a sign that says auditions. You can't make this up. And I walk in, and I meet who is going to be my mentor for the next 3 years, Dr. John Bettenbender. And Dr. Bettenbender casts a 16-year-old freshman in the lead of the senior play, which is unheard of. And that started me on my trajectory. Yeah. Rutgers.
Yeah. So you mentioned your Jamaican mom, and
yes.
I know that you spent summers there growing up. Can you talk about your time in Jamaica and how it informs the way that you approach the world?
Oh my gosh. You know, it's so interesting being from a completely different culture. Jamaica is what I consider my culture. When you would have, do you remember when they used to have those days when you were supposed to come to school as you're representing your culture? I always had Jamaica. I always had my little bandana skirt and the little white blouses, and you know, you would tie up your head. And the food was always ackee and saltfish. Well, there was no ackee to be found, so I would scramble up the eggs, and it looks like ackee. So, you know, you would always have that, and you'd have the song, and mine was, long time girl, me never see you, come make me hold your hand. So, yes, you know, Miss Louise Bennett. So I had my song, my culture, my everything. But it was so interesting because being there, you know, when you'd come here and people could never fathom things like a black president, you always knew that there were black people in leadership because the prime minister was black-ish. Yeah, you already knew that that could be achieved. The doctor, the lawyer, the politician, the librarian, everybody was black or blackish. You knew it. You already saw it. You know, I was always fascinated when people were in an uproar about black mermaids, and we've always known about black mermaids. Always, you know? When Sister Act 2 came out, I was laughing because people were like, they never heard of a black mermaid, a black nun. We saw black nuns all over the place. They didn't wear a black habit, though. They wore blue habits, you know, so it was very different. But my world had already been opened up. I already knew what was possible because I'd already seen it. So when people would tell you about what you couldn't do or don't try for this or don't try for that, in my little child's brain, I was like, you need to travel more. Yeah.
Some folks need to get out more. Yeah. So you have two adult children
Yes.
of your own, Etienne and Ivy.
Yes.
And they are making their way in the world. Tell Yeah. us a little bit about what they've been up to these days.
My children do not live at home and they do not ask me for money. I'm winning. Although I tell you, my son Etienne just got engaged. And yeah, I'm so excited. And I have loved his girlfriend from day one. I was just like, dear God, help my son make a good decision. And he did. But when he opened up the engagement ring, I said, well, it is official. My son is broke. But I was like, wow. I said to Vincent, honey, I think I need a new ring. But he's like, no. But, you know, Etienne, it's interesting with Etienne, you know, you never know how your children are looking at you. And I realized through my children, first of all, my daughter is my stylist. You know, she's been taking the whole road with me since, you know, the show I Cannot Mention, and just killing the game. If you ever look at her social media, Ivy Coco, yeah.
Well, when you sang at the Super Bowl, right?
She Oh my God, what she did with that. And I'm always thinking to myself, how the heck does she do that? But then she was always in Jamaica in my mother's atelier cutting room as my mother was manufacturing. She saw that. So somehow that came into her. With my son and the work that I do socially with people and all of that, with my nonprofit Diva, you know, Diva Foundation, I was like, my God, they were watching. They were paying attention. And I always want to tell parents have far more power than they give themselves. You know, you have to really, really look at your children, talk to your children, put the phone down, put the iPads and the tablets down, talk to your children, live a life of example because they are watching you. And you are the best thing out there for them. And I think that when I look at my kids, when I won the Emmy and I could hear them up in the balcony screaming, Mommy! Yeah! Mommy! I was like, oh my God, every labor pain was worth it! Oh, you know, I just love what they're doing. You know, Etienne has been through quite a few ups and downs. All of our children go through ups and downs, but it's how we help them go through those ups and downs. I think that mistakes are not just mistakes, I call them experience, you know, and very often when they would do things, parents would say to me, why are you so calm? I said, what do you want me to do, kill him? No, he's got to stay alive so that he can learn, you know. You know, with my daughter, you know, I try to be the best me that I can be so that she can be the best woman that she's going to grow up to be. I want and I continue to set the best example that I can for my children. And I was so very fortunate that God brought Vincent into my life because I know it's the truth. Because, you know, a lot of people, they get married, and then there's some people, especially some men, you can't leave your children with some men. And you certainly cannot leave your daughter with some men. And there's some men, when you have a son that has a certain kind of personality, they're going to hurt your son. If they don't hurt them physically, they will hurt them spiritually. And I was so very blessed to have a man come into my life. Also, I chose him. So that could be around my children and enter my family. And I see my son having made a good choice for himself with the woman who will now join our family. Yes, I'm good.
You know, you mentioned with Etienne the ups and downs, and I've heard you talk about this, and you write about it in the book, that he had a really rough time at one point, was in a serious car accident, was mugged and shot multiple times.
Yes.
It is every parent's worst nightmare.
Yes.
And I wonder if you could just briefly talk about how you got through that.
Let me tell you something. When Vincent and I were at the house, and I got a call from my daughter, and all she said was, Etienne got shot. It was as if time was just suspended. I literally threw the phone at Vincent because there was nothing I could do with that information. And all of a sudden, I felt something hot on my legs. And I literally peed on myself. Because I was in such shock that, because I heard that he was shot and in my mind he was dead. And I just couldn't get it together. I don't know how Vincent helped me get it together, but I remember we were on our way to the hospital and several things happened at the hospital that just sort of made me crazy, in that, you know, his health card says, you know, Senate of Pennsylvania, you know, state of Pennsylvania. And we had wheeled him out on the curb because it was a Friday night and they left him there. He went to his friends, because he didn't want to call us, which is always a mistake, children, call your parents. And when we got to Etienne, he had been shot in his leg. He had been shot twice in his leg, and he had a gash here. And I thought he had been pistol whipped, and come to find out he had missed the kill shot. So it was just so many horrible things. But he was about ready to lose his leg. And Vincent said, I don't know what's going on here, but we're going back to the hospital. We took Etienne back to the hospital right here. And they said, where was he? He should be in the hospital. And Vincent said, he was right here. Wow. And I learned so many things in that time. But the greatest part is, he's alive.
Well, speaking of State Senator Vincent Hughes, who is with us this evening. You all have been married for 18 years.
It feels like 40.
Long time. But you have spent a lot of that time living on opposite coasts, mm-hmm. and I wonder, how do you make that work?
You know something, marriage for, you know, everybody tries to put themselves in these little boxes that marriage is like this, and that's the way it is. No, marriage is what works for you. Vincent has his career. Now, if I were living here in Philadelphia full time with this man doing his career, we wouldn't be together this long.
A little distance is not a bad thing.
A little distance is not a bad thing. Yeah. Because you know what he loves? He loves his job. Mm. This is not a politician. This is a public servant. And he is always going to do the best for the people that he serves. Now, it would be wonderful if he just stuck to serving his constituents in the 7th Senatorial District. But no, he's got to help everybody all over the city. Which means there's hardly any free time. So when I see him every 2 weeks, I'm very happy to see him.
Okay.
Yes. And when it's time to leave, I'm very happy to leave. It works for us. Thank you.
So, speaking of service, you mentioned a moment ago the Diva Foundation.
Yes.
It has been around for a long time, and it addresses issues around HIV, AIDS, and other causes. We have come a long way, obviously, in the fight against AIDS, but people are still dying. Can you bring us up to speed and tell us, where are we in the fight against HIV?
It's very interesting. When I call myself a friend of mine, Tina McElroy Ansa, great writer. She says, the good little church girl. So I'm in the good little church girl club. Sometimes I go, sometimes I don't. But, and alarms. Good little church girl. Here I am on Broadway, and it's the best and worst of all times. And the best, of course, was being the belle of the ball on Broadway. The worst was when my friends, talented men and women, started dropping dead of this mysterious disease that had no name. And the way good people, kind people of all kinds of religions, faiths, and belief turned and showed them how much they hated them and that gay disease. The awful things people said to other human beings, little church girl couldn't understand that. So when I said, we have to do something, there are friends, there are people. Woo! Folks said, you need to shut up because nobody's going to like you. And I was like, wait a minute. So we can all work together, dance together, sing together, but now they're sick and need our help, but we can't help them? Something's not right about that. And the way people hated on gay people in the 80s, whoa, my God. It makes me sick to think about just 40-some odd years ago, we were almost as bad as we are right now. Seriously. And the way people, the vitriol of hate against other human beings. And I said, you know what? We can do better than this. So in creating the Diva Foundation, divinely inspired, victoriously, alive, audacious, awesome, if it were Sunday, we'd be anointed. I wanted us to be able to have a place to raise awareness and to always hold high the memory of my friends, because anybody that could help you with your wig, weave, weff, and wardrobe problems, they deserve to be remembered.
That's a friend.
And no matter what it is you think about other people, we are all human beings. And trust me, if you have a good gay friend, you got a good friend, baby. I'm telling you, the kind of love you will get from your good gay friend. My goodness gracious. If you call your good gay friend in the middle of the night and you say, baby, I need a cocktail. They're coming. If you wake up in the morning and you say, baby, I need a pint of blood. They're coming. You say, baby, I need a new gown. They're whipping it up on the sewing machine. So I always tell people, huh, you need to rethink what you think about gay people, because if you need a good friend, you better get yourself a good gay friend. Yes. So that's part of what we do, is really represent the fact that people are people. And we need to stop putting all these labels on people. I have lived a life where people hated black people. I have lived a life where people hated gay people. I have lived a life where people hated Asian people. I have lived a life where people hated Indians, Native Americans. I have seen this, and the hate has got to stop.
Well, I think that's a great place to put a punctuation point, but before we go to our questions from
good the grammar, I like that.
And, and by the way, we've got some folks with microphones, so just raise your hand and we'll get a microphone to you. But I always save the most difficult question for last. It's always somewhat delicate, a little bit challenging, but the question is, are Janine and Gregory going to get together or not? Good with these two.
I cannot mention the character's name, but I love her so much. There are some times when I'm working scenes with the character, and it's just like, my God, my heart for this character. It's like, oh, baby girl, my God. And then I had to meet her mother. It was like, Jesus, I understand your problems. You know, but I, when it comes to the other, the male partner of that, that boy needs some barbecue sauce. I mean, oh my God, don't mention the pizza. And I can't talk about it, but when you're in a scene and there's boiled chicken and the person is enjoying the boiled chicken, you're like, oh my God, what have they done to you? Oh, it's just so much. But I don't know what's going to happen with them. I have no idea. I don't know. I won't even put my thoughts on it. But some people, maybe they shouldn't be together.
We'll just have to tune in for season 3.
There you go.
All right. So on that note, your questions.
Hi, Ms. Ralph. Hi.
Hi.
So my question for you, so I'm going to be a senior and graduating in the spring, so I want to know what
high school,
be,
college?
College.
Okay.
I want to know, like, what would be, like, your advice for, like, navigating that and choosing, like, a path to go on, like, for, like, after that?
What did you major in?
Graphic design with a marketing minor.
Oh, I love that. So you're an artist.
Yeah.
Do you love it?
Yeah. But I also have, like, so many, like, interests and things I want to do, so I don't know how.
Okay. Lord have mercy. Okay, so you're a graphic art. You see your mother, she'll talk for you. So you're a graphic artist, designer, but you want to act?
Yes.
Well, then act. Then act. You know, there are a lot of community theaters. You know, there's probably theater there on your campus. You know, act. Get a piece of poetry. Get a monologue. Get a song. Be prepared for what it is you want to do. But you see your Jamaican mother right there?
Yes.
She may say you want to act, but she said, you know, you have to have this thing you can fall back on. I know, honey. I'm going to tell you what my father told me. You came into this world with your mother, but you will probably leave this world by yourself. So the choices that you make for yourself better be the ones that make you happy.
Thank you.
Hello, ma'am. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, sir. How are you?
Wonderful.
Good.
I'm Tracy. Hello.
That's my nephew.
You alluded to earlier in the interview how we find ourselves on these pedestals, and any day we could find ourselves off these pedestals. And
yeah.
I think no matter where you are in this world, that's true for everyone, and it resounds. So while we're on the pedestals that we find ourselves in life, what would you say is the most important thing to do when we find ourselves on those high points?
Oh. Use your platform for good. Use your platform for good. There are so many people that get on the platform and they forget how much influence and how much you can do while you're up there. People are looking to you. People, especially in times like this, they're looking for leadership. They're looking for a good message. They're looking for hope. They're looking for something that they can hold on to that will give them the strength to carry on. Because right about now, there's a whole lot of noise out there. There are a whole lot of people out there talking, and we are in a dangerous time when lies become the truth. Did you hear me?
Yes.
There are people out there lying every day. They even lie on social media. I saw someone the other day. I saw the picture. When I met them, I was like, that's not the same person. We have got to use our platforms well. And, you know, it's interesting for me now speaking, because I've been speaking like this my whole career. Nothing about me has changed except my mic is unmuted. People can hear me now. But sometimes I realize, shut up, Cheryl. Just shut up. Sometimes, you know, your inner thoughts don't always need to be outer thoughts. Sometimes you need to be quiet. And not everybody needs a mic. Some people need to stand there and just be. But then some people need to use their voice. But whatever, use your platform for good.
Mm-hmm. No questions.
So many questions. I love it. Yes, I see you in the back.
Okay.
Hi, Miss Ralph.
Oh, hi, darling.
Hi. So my question for you is, I also love acting, and that's always been something like I've wanted to do. But I feel like that's always like everybody's like, oh, that's such a hard career. Like, not a lot of people like succeed in that. And like, what's your like tip on how to be able to have that be like your future?
I have to tell you this. Do you know how hard it is to become a doctor?
Yes.
Not everybody can do it. Do you know how hard it is to be a lawyer? Not everybody can do it. Do you know how hard it is to be a good parent? Not everybody can do it. Do you know how hard it is to bake a good loaf of bread? Not everybody can do it. What's your name?
Alice.
Alice, if you want to act, Alice, act. Audition. Get out there and do it for yourself. You might be outstanding, but do you know who the number one person is that will hold you back from seeing your dreams come true?
Myself.
Thank you. Alice in the wonder of this land. Go do you. Thank you.
Oh my. All right, we have time for one more question, and I know that there was a young lady in the back there.
Yes, she's, yes. There she is, all the way in the back. Uh-huh. Chef's kiss, yes, thank you.
And guess what? It's funny, I am a chef.
Oh.
There it is.
There's your mic, girl. You want to ask me a question?
Can you give this to her? My nieces gave this
okay,
to me.
Okay, give it to me. Yes, there's always one.
Thank you.
Yes.
I want to say how much you inspire my life and how you just reconfirm everything that, like, I just know that my trials and tribulations are a journey now. And I really appreciate you and keep doing what you're doing, and I love you. And I've been following you since Sparkle, Don't Make Me Sing.
Thank you.
Well, I think that is an absolutely lovely note for us to end on. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me once again in thanking Cheryl Lee Ralph for being with us.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.